Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. And it gives us great pleasure to welcome back to our microphone here at Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, Rabbi Robin Frisch, the Director of Interfaith Family of Philadelphia. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be back.
It's nice to see you and having to come all the way over to New Jersey from beautiful Philadelphia. Interfaith Family, let's start with the basics, okay, Robin? Talk to me about Interfaith Family, what it is, how large is it? It's grown.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's headquartered in Boston.
That's right. We have a national office in Boston. When Interfaith Family was first started, it was just a website. And that website has been around now since 2001, for 16, almost 17 years. And we actually just improved the website. We have a new website, which looks fantastic. And in addition to having all of these articles and resources and blogs and basic Judaism information, in 2011, Interfaith Family began operating in various communities. So we are now in six communities across the country. We're here in Philadelphia, of course. We're also in Boston. We have a local office. We have an office in Atlanta. We are in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and we are also in Chicago, and we have an affiliate in Cleveland, and we're in D.C. as well.
Wow. So,
which actually is, I think, seven offices.
That's okay. So you're expanding. The program is expanding.
So we have expanded, and the idea is that we can really reach people and work with people in the communities. We work mostly with interfaith couples, either before or after they've had children. We help them have discussions about what it means to be an interfaith couple, what kind of family they want to create, and we advocate for welcoming in the Jewish community.
And if I'm not mistaken, on the site, there's a referral link.
We do. We have a rabbi referral service. Anyone, and this isn't just where we have offices, anywhere in the country or, in fact, internationally, anywhere in the world, if someone is looking for a rabbi or a cantor to officiate at a Jewish life cycle event, we can refer clergy.
Any life cycle event? Or just
any life cycle event.
No,
we do mostly weddings, but bar and bat mitzvahs, funerals. We've referred rabbis for unveilings, baby namings, bris, any life cycle event whatsoever.
So I guess the follow-up question as we begin, and we'll have to mention this, somebody, how do they get in touch with you? What's the secret?
So if they're looking for clergy, they can go to interfaithfamily.com/find a rabbi. But if they're really looking for anything, just interfaithfamily.com.
And you mentioned, let's unpack this a little bit. The major focus of Interfaith Family is working with first marriages, younger people, getting married in an interfaith situation. They'll come to you. They'll get, perhaps they'll look for a colleague if they haven't found somebody, a cantor or a rabbi that they know who will do the wedding. Walk me through some of those things that you offer: premarital counseling, how to's, how to raise a Jewish child.
Yes and yes.
Okay. Walk me through some of that.
So we have all different resources. A lot of it is, in fact, wherever you're located on our website, we have all of the things, the how to's, the resources. We also have an email series, for example, raising a child with Judaism in your interfaith family. We also have an email series, planning your Jewish interfaith wedding. So we have those sources that you can access no matter where you are. Then if you're in one of our communities, we do offer counseling. We're happy to meet with people. Each office has a rabbi that runs the office, so you can meet with the rabbi there. And we do programming. For example, in Philadelphia, we have our Love and Religion workshop for interfaith couples. It's a four-week workshop. So not only do you have the benefit of getting to know the rabbi in the community, but you also get to know other interfaith couples, people like yourself, who are negotiating what it means to be an interfaith couple and to create a family. We also have in Philadelphia, we have meetups. Every other month, we have an interfaith couples meetup where interfaith couples come together, and each session will have a different topic that we discuss. Last time we talked about anti-Semitism, what it's like for a Jewish partner who may have experienced anti-Semitism. what it's like for a partner who's not Jewish to be in a relationship with someone who's Jewish, how to understand them, how to support them, and what it means to perhaps have a child who's going to be raised Jewish.
So let me talk to you a little bit about the role of the non-Jewish spouse in these workshops. Mm-hmm. And so how does Interfaith Family welcome and then integrate this non-Jewish spouse who, let's assume in many cases, and you probably have the statistics, chooses not to convert. They're not going to convert.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to practice my Episcopalianism or my Protestantism, but I'm still married. How does Interfaith Family work with that non-Jewish spouse?
We come from a totally non-judgmental place. If someone does want to convert, the invitation's always there, and we would help them find a rabbi to study with them for conversion. But the vast majority of people we work with do not want to convert to Judaism, the partner who's of another faith, and that's fine with us. We want to support them as a partner. Absolutely no pressure.
How much of an interface is it with the parents of these young people who are choosing to marry, you know, in an interfaith marriage? Do you deal with the prospective in-laws on both
sides?
We
do. I can say I do that mostly individually as a rabbi when I work with couples that are getting married. I always request that I meet with the parents before, and especially the parents of the partner who's not Jewish. I think it's, you know, often easy as the Jewish side to overlook the fact that this partner's parents probably expected them to be married by a priest or a minister or, you know, whatever their own religious tradition might be. And they weren't expecting to be working with a rabbi. So I want the partner who's not Jewish for their parents to feel as comfortable as possible to have a relationship with me before the wedding. I recommend that other rabbis do this as well when they're working with interfaith couples. Really, the more that people can be involved and invested and see each other as individuals, I think the better things will be. Instead of saying, this is Jewish, this is not Jewish, to really see it as this is a person and this is someone I care about.
Does Interfaith Family have a position on co-officiation, or is it just totally a stom blank referral service and you just make your own judgment?
Right, exactly. We come from a totally non-judgmental place. So we refer rabbis who officiate. We refer rabbis who co-officiate. If you're looking specifically for a co-officiant, when you're filling out the form, you would note that. There's a place where we ask if there's going to be clergy of another faith, and then you would only get a list of rabbis who would co-officiate. We really don't want couples to be told no. So many young couples, even Jewish-Jewish couples, are feeling alienated from the Jewish community that we see our role as creating as wide open of a door as possible. So
this is one of the things that I'd like to explore with you, if you don't mm-hmm. mind. And you've worked for Interfaith Family for how long? Quite a while, right?
Yeah, over 4 years.
So, and I'm sure you studied the statistics and everything, and I'm old enough to remember when I worked for the union for the Reformed Judaism, Rabbi Schindler of Blessed Memory's 1978 speech, because I had just joined the mm-hmm. staff, which just set everything in motion, all the outreach stuff. In your experience now working with young couples, is there, and as a rabbi in the community, and people should know, you're active in the Philadelphia Jewish community, are you sensing a greater acceptance of interfaith couples within the Jewish community? Is that stigma, as it, you know, from 30 years ago, oh my God, it's the end of the Jewish community if you marry out? Has that really just gone away?
I wouldn't say it's totally gone away, but I would say that it's a lot less. More and more synagogues are coming and saying, how do we attract interfaith couples? They're doing that because 71% of Jews, according to the Pew report of 2013, 71% of Jews who are getting married in the liberal Jewish community are marrying someone of another faith.
Stop.
71%. 58% overall, but if you take out Orthodox Jews, it's 71% of Jews getting married. I believe this was between 2005 and 2010. So perhaps the numbers have even gone up a little bit.
And this is for non-Orthodox. This is conservative, reform, reconstructionist, renewal, worshiping the sun, or whatever, standing on the street corner, Jews.
Right. But even if you count Orthodox Jews, it's still 58%. It's over half.
Wow.
So there's a recognition by synagogue leadership that this is the future of the Jewish community. And if we don't bring interfaith families into our synagogues and into our Jewish institutions, we are not going to have synagogues outside of the Orthodox community, and we're not going to have thriving Jewish institutions.
How is the Orthodox community reacting to you? Are you working within the Orthodox at all, or that it's just like the barrier is up?
We have not worked with the Orthodox community. We have one very modern Orthodox synagogue that has participated in Interfaith Family Month in November, which we have each November in Philadelphia, but I think that's more of an exception. The Orthodox community has not requested our help, and we have not worked with them.
So with this number and with what you're observing, there's a less of a stigma, but there's still a concern out there in the community. Talk to me about how you work with synagogues. You know, Temple Anshe Whoopi calls you up. It's a great synagogue, by the way. And
I'm still waiting for their call.
You know, and they call you up and say, look, you know, we're noticing this trend, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What can you, is you, a typical question, I'm sure, from I remember from, the, what can you do for us?
Sure. So we can come in and provide a training, and I can work with the synagogue staff and the lay leadership and help them to use language that's more welcoming of interfaith families. We'll do everything from talk about how the website and the membership forms, religious school forms can be more welcoming, as well as the personal interaction of how you talk to people and what kind of programming you provide. We also have something new this year called the Interfaith Inclusion Leadership Initiative, and it's a national initiative to train synagogues over a year. It's a year-long training process. So our first cohort is actually in the process right now. And we have, I believe there are 10 synagogues and institutions in that first cohort.
From around the country?
All over the country.
Okay.
But there are four from the state of Pennsylvania. And the next cohort is actually hopefully going to beginning in the spring of 2018.
So this training encompasses what? It's a year-long training. Synagogue signs up, doesn't cost them anything, or it costs them something to
join? Does cost something.
Okay. And I'm sending a cohort of, let's say, my membership people or whatever. What's going to take place in that year-long training? That's a tremendous commitment.
Yes. Yeah, so I believe that they ask for 2 to 4 leaders from the synagogue, professional as well as lay leaders, to commit to being part of this. And right now, our first cohort, it's involved webinars. So there's a webinar about once a month. And there, I happen to lead the one on language and optics. So that was on dealing with what your website looks like and what your written materials look like. And then there are lots of webinars on different topics related to being welcoming to people from interfaith families. And the next cohort, I believe, will have an in-person kickoff. It's going to be in Philadelphia and one other city to be determined, that they'll have the in-person kickoff. And then there'll be the year-long program with webinars and other. There's also a coach who keeps in touch with you and works with the synagogue to fulfill an action plan that they set up at the beginning of the year.
Now, you'll work with synagogues even if the rabbis of the synagogues do not perform interfaith marriages.
We do. That, for example, the ILI initiative includes conservative synagogues. And in conservative synagogues, the rabbis are not allowed
not to
perform
interfaith
marriages.
How far ranging, you're based here in Philly, but that I'm sure your territory, quote unquote, mm-hmm. if I can just use that, extends how wide is your reach, your personal reach, for interfaith family?
So we really cover Philly and South Jersey. Mm-hmm. And actually we have a group starting up in January in South Jersey. It's going to be a group of interfaith couples who've got children of different ages, and we're going to meet for dinner. So the first meeting is just going to be a group of women. We're all going to meet and just discuss. It's going to be a holiday debrief to talk about issues that might have come up during the December holidays. For most of them, I believe it's Christmas and, of course, Hanukkah. And then we'll get together with their partners a couple months later. And then a couple months after that, we'll get together again with the partners. Really just a safe space to talk about issues, both the blessings and the challenges of being in an interfaith relationship.
So I have to, how many, do you know for off the top of your head for this group? It's starting mm-hmm. in South Jersey. How many people?
We're hoping to have just 6 to 8 couples. We want it to be a nice, intimate group.
Do you know if all of them or any of them are affiliated with the synagogue?
I do not know. We're just forming the group now.
You know, in the groups that you are familiar that you run in Greater Philadelphia, what the percentage of people are who attend these groups who are affiliated with synagogues off the top of your head?
I don't know, although since the people we work with tend to be people who have not yet had children or very young children, mm-hmm. most of them are not yet affiliated with synagogues, although they often are looking for somewhere to go for the high holidays, somewhere to connect with and maybe stay with and grow with.
Have you had any reaction at all from the rabbis in South Jersey? Do they know about this group?
No, this is something new, I guess, unless they hear this.
Oh, wow. So it'd be very interesting to see, because my sense is that, as you just pointed out, probably the majority of couples who interface with interfaith family are not affiliated yet with a synagogue, because, as you said, they don't have children. And they're just starting this journey.
So this particular group, I've been working with a couple of women who are really spearheading it, looking for other people to join the group. I do believe that they are both connected to synagogues, although I'm not 100%
sure. That's interesting. I'm interested to see the reaction. We're speaking with Rabbi Robin Frisch, the director of the Interfaith Family Office here in Philadelphia, and we're speaking about the whole wide menu of offerings for interfaith family, not only here in Philly, but around the country. And again, somebody wants to get in touch with Interfaith Family, what's the website?
The website is interfaithfamily.com. And if they want to see what's going on in Philadelphia, they can go to interfaithfamily.com/Philadelphia.
What's the December dilemma?
So I would say,
other than sports,
my interfaith family colleagues and I would say, there's no dilemma. We don't use the term December dilemma. We like to use terms like December dialogue, because there's a recognition that, yes, there are challenges in being in an interfaith relationship, but there are also blessings. So it can be hard for many families how to celebrate the holidays. I think it's a little bit easier a year like this year where Hanukkah and Christmas don't overlap. But still, for a family who's raising their children with Judaism, either exclusively or with some other religion exposure as well, it can be a challenge. How much of that religion do you expose them to? And one of the issues I see all of the time is Christmas trees. I actually wrote a blog once called Talking About Christmas Trees in July, because no matter what, if I get together with a group of interfaith couples, the issue of whether or not they have Christmas trees comes up. And it's often a very contentious relationship for two partners. Partners work it out in different ways. And I think the most important thing is to be able to have the conversation, to be able to explain to your partner why you do or do not want a Christmas tree, what it means to you if you grew up with one. And sometimes the hardest thing is really to listen to your partner and hear what it means to them.
I would imagine, does Interfaith Family have a quote, official position?
We do not.
Yeah, everything on Interfaith, and if I'm listening to you correctly, there is no, quote, official positions that you should. There's
exactly.
No shoulds, musts. It's basically encouraging couples to come to a meaningful conversation and decision based upon their own dynamics.
That's exactly. We're not going to give the best practices for being an interfaith couple, but really it's about
10 top tips.
We can give tips on communication.
Right.
But what's right for one couple isn't necessarily right for another couple.
So the interfaith issue, do you have a statistic on because that's reflecting on my own, rabbinate and career in doing these marriages since I was ordained. The majority of the Jewish people are marrying non-Jews. What religious persuasion those non-Jews are, has that changed, or do you have a sense of what?
I don't know statistically, certainly in my own experience, the couples that I'm working with, which of course is informed by the area where I live, most of them are Jewish Christian couples, although we do see Jewish Hindu couples we've worked with. I spoke recently to a Jewish Muslim couple and a few Jewish Buddhist couples. But I would imagine, just based on the demographics of our country, that Jewish Christian is the highest.
And particular denomination in Christianity?
I can tell you in my own experience, yeah. I meet a lot of Jewish Catholic couples.
Yeah. Mine too. It seemed to be ranked number one.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's just based on where we are in the country or the couples that end up coming to a place like Interfaith Family.
Talk to me a little bit about your Interfaith Family's experience. I'm sure you must have had it in the offices around the country about the seeming rise of interracial marriages and stuff like that. So you get involved with that, I'm sure.
You know, interfaith relationships, of course, are going to overlap with other types of inter. So there's going to be interracial relationships. We end up dealing with people. People in LGBTQ relationships, of course, are in interfaith relationships as well. And these are just other issues, I think, for discussion. It's if you grew up in a different religious tradition than your partner, a different culture, a different country, a different, you know, ethnic background, all of these things are going to be differences that you learn to navigate as a couple. And again, I think all of them can ultimately bring richness to your relationship and if you choose to get married, to your marriage.
So the organized, quote unquote, organized Jewish community, still there's significant segments of it, and you see the articles, and my colleagues and I see the articles, who will still raise the flag of this is the beginning of the end of the American Jewish community. And I'm sure in your staff meetings and the way you approach this, this comes up all the time, and I'm sure you handle it. How do you begin to handle that now, you know, decades old criticism, which may be based on fear, which may be based on who know what, but it's still out there?
Well, part of my response would be we're still here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people have been saying for years it's the beginning of the end. The intermarriage rate has continued to grow, but the Jewish community is still here. So I think that it's definitely reflecting a change in the Jewish community. The Jewish community, especially the liberal community, has always evolved and always changed. This is where we are now. And I think that we as a community have to navigate how we're going to include people from other religious backgrounds, how we're going to really welcome them entirely as their whole person in our community. And yes, it's going to change the Jewish community, but I don't see that as a bad thing.
So I want to play around with this idea, because when I'm on the road for Jewish Sacred Aging, and we always talk about the shifts that are taking place and have taken place, let's say from the 70s on, and this the radical restructuring of a lot of the community. Do you see us, because you're working in the trenches with this particular expanding community, do you really sense, or do you sense that we are creating, in essence, a brand new American United States Judaism that's basically honed to our country? It's not even exportable.
I think we've done that a number of years ago. As you said, back in the 70s or before then, we have been creating a Judaism that is different than the Judaism we inherited. The Judaism of my grandparents is already different than the Judaism I grew up in, and the Judaism my children are growing up in is different from that. So I think we are continuing to create a new Judaism, and that bringing interfaith families into our communities will continue to help that evolve and change in unique ways.
What brought you to this? What brought you to, I mean, you were ordained from?
Hebrew Union College.
So what brought you to interfaith family? Was there something in your own dynamic, or was it you were sense called by this? Or?
So I think what brought me to this, as trite as it sounds, is people. I was ordained in the year 2000, and I was very clear at that point that I would never officiate an interfaith wedding. I said, it's fine if people want to get married, but that's not my role as a rabbi. And I saw things as very black and white. And then after being a congregational rabbi for a few years and working with real people in real life situations and seeing people in interfaith marriages, and sometimes I think of one family where the mom is Christian and the dad is Jewish, and they raised Jewish children but had a Christmas tree in the home for the mom. And she went to church every week and synagogue every Friday night. It was synagogue on Friday nights and church on Sunday. And seeing what a beautiful Jewish home that family created, and seeing other families like that, that navigated the realities of more than one religious tradition, and realizing that this is real people, and that real people live in the gray areas, not in the black and white areas, and wanting to work in that area is what brought me to that. So eventually I started to officiate interfaith weddings, found it incredibly rewarding. When I saw that the interfaith family position of director of Philadelphia office was open, I felt like this was really a job for me, that this was a job that would incorporate so much of what I love doing, working with couples and working with families, and also the advocacy piece of advocating for these families within the Jewish community.
When you started to work with these couples, was there something that changed within you? Can you spotlight, can you focus in on one? Was it a spiritual shift, an emotional shift? Theological shift? You didn't, did you, you, I mean, that's fascinating, because I know a number of our colleagues started out this way, and after several years in their congregation, shifted. Sometimes they shifted because the pressure from their leadership and from the people, you know, made it easier. And sometimes they felt, as your journey, these are my people, and if I don't take care of them, then I'm absenting myself from a very important part of their life. But what, when you started to work with these couples, what was going on?
I think for me, it was just my own passion and love for Judaism, which all of us who choose this path, who choose to become clergy, obviously have that. And realizing I didn't want to cut that off from these people who were sometimes really looking for that, that these couples would come to me and they would ask me, will you marry me? And really, in many ways, they were asking more than that. They were asking, will you approve of my relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And will you accept me into the Jewish community? And I realized that I had this tremendous power to say yes or no, and that my answer became about so much more than just the wedding. And to be able to welcome people to Judaism, whether they grew up Jewish or not, there's so much that our rich tradition has to offer, that why can't someone who grew up Christian, who may still be Christian, if they want to experience Judaism with the person they love, why would I want to turn them away from that?
Your experience, this is something that came up. I remember in the beginning of the outreach movement, when we were developing these programs, when I directed the region here, and we ran this huge program, there was a perception out there in Amcha that person who's choosing to marry someone who's not Jewish really is rejecting their Judaism, was running away. But the opposite often is true, isn't it? Walk me through that.
So I think that especially now, people fall in love who they fall in love with. And it's not necessarily seen if you fall in love with someone who's not Jewish. It doesn't mean you're rejecting your Judaism. You could love being Jewish. You just happen to love someone who's from another tradition. And I think that our community historically would make that assumption that you're talking about. Well, if they're marrying someone who's not Jewish, they must not care about Judaism. But in fact, quite the opposite could be true. And so not only can we keep a Jew, so to speak, within the community, we gain a friend of the Jews. Again, that person may one day decide to become Jewish. I'm sure we all know the people who attend their child's bar bat mitzvah, and then it's after that they decide to become Jewish, or right before that. But whether or not they decide to become Jewish, they love a Jew, and they are often willing to become part of the extended community. So again, for me, it's all about wide open doors.
Yeah, I think if you do this long enough, you do see. I'm just thinking of a guy. I did their wedding. They actually brought in one day a picture, and I said, "Geez, who's that? Who's the guy under the chuppah?" And they burst out laughing. And said, you fool. That's what, like 30 years ago. But he raised children, and he was very active and supportive. And all of a sudden, he walked into my office 3 or 4 years ago and said, "I'm ready."
Yeah.
And there was no reason, you know, he didn't have young, he was just ready. And it was a fascinating moment when he stood on the bima and completed this journey. And I agree with you. I mean, the open door policy, I think, and the welcoming policy, in this day and age, I mean, your success of Interfaith Family and the expansion of it proves, I think, the idea of welcoming, openness, non-judgmental, and this is a home, or this is a place that you could possibly feel good about.
And I just think when you tell that story, that had he converted before the wedding, just so he could marry the person he married, how much less meaningful the conversion probably would have been for him and probably for the rabbi.
Oh, I think, you know, that, and again, to mirror what you're saying, every case is individual, but I think in general, you're absolutely correct. I mean, when the spirit moves you, that's the time.
Yeah.
And
it might never be the time again, but there's so many people who contribute so much to the community, whether it's bringing their children to religious school or supporting a spouse. There's so many other ways that people who never become Jewish can still contribute to the Jewish community, or maybe they don't. Maybe they say to their partner, this isn't for me.
This is yours.
I'm sitting this out.
Right.
This is yours. And that's okay too. That's going to be a choice that some people make.
When you work with couples, they come to you, they're in the premarital phase, the premarital counseling that you're doing, and because you officiate at weddings too.
Yeah.
How do we handle that famous phrase that all of us have heard when we start talking about children? And I'll say to you, well, Rabbi Frisch, we're going to just let little Shloimi or Crystal make up their own mind. And how do you, how do you handle that? How does interfaith family handle it? How do you handle it?
I really just try to encourage their discussion about that. I will often respond when couples say that every child's going to make up their own mind. You know, my children are 11 and 15 and 17.
Oh.
And they've made up their, you know, depending on their age, each of
them. Wait till their 30s and 40s.
Making up their own mind. What actually surprises me more is when couples think they have control over how their children are going to turn out. And I just kind of laugh.
They'll learn. Yeah.
But, you know, I tell them that I really think it's about creating the home you want to create and the atmosphere you want to create. And of course, all children are going to decide when they grow up. But you create the home that you want to create for you because it's the right thing for you and your partner. The children will see what you model and hopefully, you know, will make good choices, whatever that means for them.
Let me move into something a little less happy, but also very real, very real. You work with interfaith couples. You and your colleagues are excited, will marry. What happens, and does interfaith family get involved in any type of situation following, you know, it happens, divorce, where, again, you may have a child as a pawn or not? Does interfaith family get involved with any type of support mechanism to that Jewish or even perhaps non-Jewish spouse who may come back to you and say, look, you were there for me 10 years ago. This is what I'm going through. Help me.
So having only been in this office for 4.5 years, we haven't fortunately had a lot of divorce since we've been marrying people as part of interfaith family. Of course, that's the reality is going to happen. And I would say that we would be there as individual rabbis to provide support for the couple as they need. There's no policy of this is what we do or this is how you should do things. But again, would be there to facilitate between a couple to help them come up with something that works best for them.
And have you dealt with the tragedy of a death of a spouse and the follow-up of that, the residual of that?
I have not, thank goodness, personally.
Because I always, you know, I'm just thinking of just scenarios that, you know, also having to do with will planning, estate planning, burial planning. Do you get involved with cemetery issues too? The non-Jewish spouse being buried with, do you get involved with that at all, interfaith has? Or do you acknowledge any of the staff gotten involved with that?
More that we provide resources for that, and we provide, I know we have a booklet on death and burial that gives you the questions that you would ask if you're the partner who's not Jewish, so you would know what to ask when your partner passes away. If people are looking for a specific cemetery, then the rabbi in the community could help them find a cemetery where they could be buried with their partner. But we haven't dealt with that as much at this point.
How important, in your experience, this is probably, you know, well, we'll see, in the working through of the marriage is and the raising of the children, a very, very supportive, you know, that supportive family and friendship network. I'm sure you've dealt with, I would have you dealt with those situations where this couple comes to you, you work with them, but there's still that barrier with the family, their biological family is still putting up some sort of resistance
to a partner of another
family. Yeah.
And I also get calls quite often from the Jewish parents who are just having a hard time that their child is with someone who's not Jewish. And a lot of that is me talking through them that doesn't mean, just as we had talked about, it doesn't mean the end of their Jewish commitment and the end of their connection to Judaism. And really for parents of adult children to learn to respect their adult children's choices. And that's a hard thing to do.
No matter how old the child is, as all of us somehow find out sooner or later. The referral thing, and again, we're talking with Rabbi Robin Frisch, who's the director of Interfaith Family Office here in Philadelphia, part of a national network of offices, 6 or 7 regional offices around the United States of America. Do you stuff with Canada?
We do not.
Why not?
We just only have so many offices at this point, but we do refer rabbis in Canada for life cycle events. I've actually spoken to some people in Canada and actually just happened the other day to speak to a woman in Canada, needed some advice. She had been with her son. She herself is in an interfaith marriage. Her husband's not Jewish. She raised three kids. Her son just moved in with his girlfriend who's not Jewish. And she loves the girlfriend, but was very upset when the girlfriend announced the other day she was going to have a Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
So she called me to talk to me about it. And she just wanted me to tell her, in essence, that they can still have Jewish children and have a Christmas tree in the home. And I did assure her that just because they have a Christmas tree, it does not mean that they cannot have wonderful, involved Jewish children.
Do you have a sense of the pattern of interfaith marriage children who maintain their Jewish identity? I've seen statistics all over the wall about, yes, the more interfaith marriages, the children of those marriages, there's less of a percentage when they grow up, identify within the Jewish community. So people use this as the trickle-down argument, say, over the course of the next generations. What's your experience?
I would say that I've obviously seen the statistics as well, but I think the reality is that these statistics are from a time, even just 10 years ago, when the Jewish community was not as welcoming, which is why we advocate for the community to be welcoming, to really explore ritually what roles parents who are not Jewish can have, how interfaith families can feel comfortable in Jewish communities. And we strongly believe, and I strongly believe, that as people in interfaith families feel more comfortable in Jewish spaces and their kids feel more comfortable affirming their Judaism, that these kids are going to grow up with strong Jewish identities, be more likely to hold on to that and pass that on to their own children. So I think part of the reason we've seen that people from interfaith homes are less likely to be involved Jewishly is because they weren't welcomed Jewishly.
But you sense that is changing.
I do sense that's changing.
Well, my experience is right now as I travel around that it is more, I haven't been in a congregation in God knows how long that is not open and welcoming and absolutely, and sometimes very proud of the fact that they have such a huge number of interfaith couples, some of whom are on the board. I know from teaching at our seminary that, you know, they're now rabbis and student rabbis who were born not Jewish, converted to Judaism, and now going through the seminary. So they're, you know, and, I mean, this is part of this change, this evolution that began, you know, several decades ago. We don't know where it's going, but I think if you approach it from this accepting, creative, possibility, positive approach, we have a better chance of making sense out of it. Let me put it that way. One of the other issues that I wanted to talk to you about in your work, and you told me that this is not a huge priority right now, but do you get involved with second marriages, a number of which are interfaith marriages? And if so, what's the difference that you've noticed in how you approach that?
We get involved to the extent people come to us. So if someone, you know, if a couple comes to us and they're in a second marriage and maybe that's an interfaith marriage, which might mean that there are stepchildren who are a different religion. So you might have stepchildren who are Christian and your children are Jewish. And then these children become siblings and you create this blended family. And that's, again, that's the reality of what's happening more and more in America and the beauty of diverse families that we're seeing every day more and more of this.
So does Interfaith Family in Philly do any work in the what I'll call subsequent marriages? Because second, third, whatever, they're not necessarily rooted to people in their 70s and 80s.
Sure.
People in their 30s and 40s. Yeah.
I had a couple actually a few years ago in my Love and Religion workshop, and she was Christian and her partner, he was Jewish, and they each had a child. They each had a son. One was Jewish and one was Christian. They subsequently got married and had a child together. So here they have this blended family with children of different religions. And they actually came to an interfaith family program at my house on Sukkot. And one of the little boys had just come from religious school. So he knew all about the sukkah and knew the blessings and was really excited. And his stepbrother-to-be at the time came up to me and he said, you know, I'm Christian. And I said, that's great. I'm Jewish. Welcome to my house. Let me show you my sukkah. So, you know, I think they're very typical of the kind of families that we're going to see more and more of.
Yeah. And with that, And certainly in the work that I do in with boomers and above, that there's that's not unusual anymore for not only people who are getting married, but people who are in, you know, consensual relationships without marriage, you know, cohabitating. It's more of a sense of I want to be with someone. I don't want to be alone. And, you know, if they happen to be Episcopalian or Lutheran, well, okay, but that's not an issue right now for me because I'm here and whatever, my adult children are settled. I mean, it's fascinating to me because I think this is really, I see this more and more and more evolving. And I would assume that eventually over the course of the next decade or so, interfaith family will probably will get a little bit more involved, like the grandparenting thing. And I know we talked a little bit about that. I know that's not a major program policy push of interfaith. You have enough to do with first marriage. In the course of your work in these last several years with interfaith family, have you bumped into any situations regarding people calling you saying, I'm a grandparent, my children are married to somebody who's not Jewish, and I'm struggling with how to deal with my grandchildren who are products of an interfaith marriage?
Sure, we hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. Again, I get a call, I think, a lot from Jewish grandparents, and I think part of it is just talking to a rabbi who tells them it's okay. You know, there's nothing to be ashamed of. You didn't fail. You didn't do anything wrong. But again, the advice I really give them is to follow the lead of their adult children, that children are making choices, you know, their parents themselves, and how they want their kids to be raised has to be respected, and it can be difficult. And always to ask your children, for example, if you want to take your children to a Jewish concert or take your grandchildren to some other Jewish event, if they're not being raised Jewish, then I would not do so without the parents' permission. I think nothing is worse than alienating the parents, your adult children, mm-hmm. Which is only going to alienate you from your grandchildren ultimately.
Do you get a sense when you even talking to the first marriage, the couples you're dealing with, and a parent will call you as you've alluded to, mm-hmm. that you get these calls? And I'm sure sometimes they're anxious. Do you get the word failure a lot? Where have I failed? You know, I sent my kid to Israel and the birthright and this and the other thing.
I think there's a real sense of shame. Really? And I've even had people say to me, oh, if I just sent my kids to a Jewish day school instead of so-and-so school. And, you know, I always say there's no protection against an interfaith marriage, nor should there be. And that it's not what you did as a parent. It's the individual person that your child fell in love with. And that's really what it's about. It's not about where they went to school or how many times they went to Israel or what day of the week they went to Hebrew school. It's about who they fell in love with, and it's not a reflection of their commitment to Judaism necessarily, and it's probably not a rejection of their parents. It's really simply about love.
But it's interesting you use the word shame.
Yeah.
You know, why? I mean, I said failure, you said shame.
Yeah, I think that parents feel often a real sense of embarrassment. It's one of those things they still whisper. They'll say to me, you know, even someone who knows that I work for interfaith family will say to me, my child's married to this really nice girl, but she's not Jewish. And right. They almost whisper that part of it as if they can't even bear to say it out loud. And my response is always, well, is she nice? Does she treat your child well? Is she good with your grandchildren? And, you know, then that might lead to a discussion about religion, and we can talk about that. And there can be a real sense of loss for a parent. If you expected to have Jewish grandchildren and your grandchildren are being raised in another religious tradition, that is a real sense of loss, and it's not something that you've chosen. And I think that sense of loss needs to be felt and acknowledged, but that doesn't mean that you should take your grandchildren and, you know, secretly start doing all kinds of Jewish things with them.
So that leads to a question also about programming of interfaith. Do you I guess for the want of a better term, support network, support groups for parents whose children are marrying interfaith? Do you do that?
We do not, although I do individual consultations, mm-hmm. and I'm always happy to talk to parents.
Because from what you're telling me, that those emotions, the failure, the shame thing, it's very interesting. Do other offices do? Do you know if the other offices?
No, not currently.
Wow, that's interesting.
We do have a lot of online resources, and all of the directors individually do provide support.
Wow. And all the direct, I would assume, this maybe a silly question, but, you know, what the heck. I've seen all the directors of all the regional offices. Are they all rabbis?
They are all rabbis.
And they all do interfaith family, interfaith weddings?
Yes.
Okay.
They all officiate.
And the referral thing, just because it popped into my head too, the referral thing on interfaith family on the website to find a person, a rabbi, a cantor who does life cycle events, regardless of the life cycle, brises, everything, mm-hmm. baby namings to weddings.
Yes. And I will say, by the way, that most of the couples, because they're coming to interfaith family, the vast majority are raising their children Jewish. Mm-hmm. Many are exposing them to the other religion in various ways. And again, that's where the non-judgmental on our part comes in. And we will be the Jewish resource for that, whatever else they may or may not be doing in the family. So when the families that we're dealing with really are, because they are raising the kids Jewish, it's often not as difficult for those grandparents. Because for those grandparents, they see their child being raised with Judaism.
Do you have a sense of how many couples that you've handled either individually or through the groups in Philly and in your particular office area have wound up going and joining synagogues?
I'm seeing more and more join synagogues. Again, yeah. I've been at Interfaith Family 4 years, so these are very young families that we're talking about.
Yeah,
I've had, actually, I can think of just off the top of my head, like one couple in Delaware that had done our workshop. And before they even got pregnant, they've since had a baby. They said, can you recommend a synagogue that would be good for us? Because we want to join before we have a child. Uh-huh. So they went and they connected with a rabbi there. And I'm often making these connections. Again, it's usually around the high holidays. They'll want to go meet a rabbi,
right.
check out the synagogue. But then many do go on to join. And then there are many others who, at least as of now, are not interested in a synagogue, but they may be later.
Right now, let's say moving into 2018, what are the groups that you're running out of IFF in Philly?
So right now we've got, coming up in January, we have our Love and Religion workshop for interfaith couples. Our 4-week workshop starts January 30th. And the week before that, we have a interfaith couples meetup on January 23rd. And both of those are taking place in Center City.
And you're starting something in Jersey?
And then we're going to have this group in Jersey of couples with children of various ages to take time to get together and talk about what it's like to raise kids in an interfaith home.
And that'll meet where? Just curious.
It's going to be at a few restaurants. I don't know off the top of my head. No. But if people are interested, they can always reach me at robynf, R-O-B-Y-N-F, at interfaithfamily.com.
And the website again?
Interfaithfamily.com.
What's the most powerful thing that you've learned working for IFF?
Great question. The most powerful thing I've learned is that I'm just totally in awe of how couples can really make things work and respect each other and sometimes listen to a partner about something that's really hard to hear and then come to honor that.
If you had right now the opportunity just to have the Jewish community stop and listen to you about what you do and give them one piece of advice about interfaith couples and interfaith marriage, what would it be?
These couples are the Jewish community. They're not a problem. They are an opportunity for us. They're a reality for us. Let's find ways to welcome them, to include their stories in the story of the Jewish people.
So Rabbi Robin Frisch, the Director of Interfaith Family Office here in Philadelphia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a lot of work, a lot of great work. I'm sure you're not bored.
No, never bored.
And again, before we move into the commentary section for this morning's show, contact information for Interfaith Family, for you, for the referrals, what are they?
So if someone's looking for a rabbi for a life cycle event, it's interfaithfamily.com/find-a-rabbi. Our website is interfaithfamily.com, and I can be reached at Robyn, R-O-B-Y-N-F, as in Frisch, at interfaithfamily.com.
So continued good luck and success, and
thank you
for this morning. It was really great. Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate it. Continued success. Good luck. Happy end of Hanukkah, and enjoy some time off.
Thank you.
And keep in touch, and I'm sure we'll bump into each other, I hope, in the future. This is Robin Frisch, Rabbi Robin Frisch, the director of the Interfaith Family Office here in Philadelphia. What we want to turn to now in this last couple of moments is an ongoing feature here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. We've invited some commentaries from some colleagues around the country from a broad range of experience. And we welcome back to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, Rabbi Jeff Salkin, and his commentary that he's entitled, My Theological Clock is Ticking.
Hi, this is Rabbi Jeff Salkin at Temple Solel in Hollywood, Florida, for another installment of My Theological Clock is Ticking, in which we talk about the seminal moments in our lives. For those of you who are boomers, who are looking back at the moments that created the way we are and the way we look at the world, it's about the Six-Day War. 50 years ago, I became a Jew. Now, that will, I think, confuse some of you because I am older than 50 years old. But I will say to you that in May 1967, the State of Israel confronted an existential threat. Surrounded by Arab armies, threatened by an Egyptian blockade of the Straits of Tiran, which would have crushed its economy, Israel was forced to act, and to act with alacrity. It was early June, and the war began, and on the Friday night of the war, my family went to synagogue, which was not something that we did on a regular basis at that time, and we prayed and we sang with a congregation that was the size of a Yom Kippur crowd. That was how deeply Jews needed to be with other Jews, and that is how deeply we needed to be with God. We use the word game changer a lot, and it has become a cliche. But I will tell you that if you look at American Jewish history, the Six-Day War was the game changer. The Six-Day War brought us Jewish studies on college campuses, robust youth movements, Jewish culture, and Jewish activism. I must insert into this story the character of Mr. Hal Goldman. That is not his real name. He was the youth advisor for our junior youth group at our synagogue. He was a decent man, and truth be told, he was a little old to be running a junior youth group, and we were not an easy group of kids. But he was very kind to us, and we treated him like an uncle. During the week of the Six-Day War, he gathered a bunch of us together, and he stood in front of us, and he had the roster of the synagogue in his hand. And he took the roster, and he tore out each page, and he gave each kid a page. He then made us memorize a speech about Israel, about what was going on. He said to us, you're going to call the people on your list, and you're going to talk to them, and you're going to ask them for money for Israel. And we did it. That was my first experience as a Jewish activist. It was romantic. It was heady. It was powerful. It filled me with the notion that I, a skinny, gawky, nerdy 13-year-old kid, could actually participate in the great unfolding drama of modern Jewish history. That was June 1967. Let me tell you what happened. A few years ago, I started to think about Hal Goldman, and I realized that I had never thanked him for what he had done. I gambled on the fact that he was still alive. And so I called him. I found his phone number. I reached him. And I said to him, Hal, I was one of your youth group kids. My name is Jeff Salkin, and I am now a rabbi. I don't remember you. Well, that's okay. Let me tell you what you did. It was during the Six-Day War in 1967. You got all the kids together. You taught us how to raise money. And you actually helped me feel heroic. I don't remember doing that. Well, I said to him, it's okay that you don't remember it. I remember it, and God remembers it. You were my first tzedakah teacher. Since then, I have taught many people about tzedakah, and I've taught many people about Israel. What did you say your name was? Jeff Salkin, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that you taught us that Judaism was far more than simply a religion. You taught us that we were members of a people. You taught us that we were members of a tribe. You taught us that this tribe was our extended family. You taught us that we have responsibilities to our people, and those are responsibilities that we can never abandon. You empowered us. You made us believe that we could help save the Jewish people. I don't remember this. I'm sorry. Whenever I pray the traditional silent prayer in the service, I always fix my mind on a certain phrase. Benafshi ke'afar l'kol tehiyah, which the prayer book does not translate accurately, but which really means, may my soul be as afar for everyone. Afar means dust, but it also means soil. And what that really means, therefore, is that our soul can be the soil. Our soul can be the soil, the potting soil in which other souls can grow. We're asking that God can make our soul into the soil that will fertilize other souls. What we want in our lives is for our souls to count. We want our souls to be useful. We want to be fertile ground for ourselves and for others. 50 years ago was not only the Six-Day War. 50 years ago was my encounter with Mr. Hal. I somehow doubt that he's still alive, but he reminds me and reminds all of us that each and every soul has the power to sustain other souls. Each and every human being has the potential to raise up students. Each and every human being can help those in need and can be of value. And when we do that, we transcend ourselves and we become like stars that shine in the heavens. Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Salkin, and thank you for being part of today's broadcast. And thank you, Rabbi Frisch, again, for being part of our experience here. Here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, these shows are archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and our website, JewishSacredAging.com. And again, we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or like the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubeckan Global Media here in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey, under the control of Steve Lubeckan. Thank you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Richard Address. Thank you and shalom.